Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and William, AC2ZV, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many of the topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder. And as a starting off point to discuss technical concepts, tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can simply type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an EchoLink node available. Just point your EchoLink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. All of this information can also be found on our club's website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and William, AC2ZV, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net tonight, William AC2ZV. Good evening, William. Don't seem to hear him. We'll be waiting for William. I will throw it out to the audience if we have an audience. If anyone has any questions or comments tonight for the TechNet, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Well, I hope there isn't something going wrong with the repeater or my shack or something. It looks like I'm transmitting. I hope that I'm transmitting. And it's maybe simply be that there's no one on the other end. So once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is supposed to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if there's anyone out there who has any questions or comments for the Technical Net, I will drop and listen for them. If we continue hearing silence, it's going to be rather short tonight. But we'll see what happens. It would indicate that I'm transmitting. Hopefully I'm transmitting audio. That would be nice. If there's anyone out there, just to make sure that my signal is perceivable, I'd like a signal check at the very least. So if there's anyone out there who would like to provide a signal check, please do that. I'm at a bit of a loss, so I thank you for the signal check. I thank you for informing me that I am transmitting properly. So once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. Now, the next one is supposed to be the fourth Wednesday of the month, which is right between Christmas and New Year's. And I figure that because of the holiday season, most people are going to be doing other things. So that's been kind of canceled. So it looks like this one might have been canceled by non-activity out there. But I will give it a try again. This is AC2GS. If anyone has any questions or comments for the Kings County Radio Club TechNet, please hit that push to talk. One more minute for someone to make a question or a comment. Otherwise, I will wish you all well for this year, and we'll try this again in 2024. So this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. You got 1 minute.
Roy, this is AC2ZV. Roy, this is AC2ZV checking in for the TechNet. I got a question for you. Hopefully you've got a minute for that. Hopefully you hear me. I'm checking in over Echolink, and I'll be at the radio in a minute.
Transmitting, but it was just kind of me, myself, and I. But I'll give you a little time to get to your radio.
Okay, hi, over here.
Yes, hello, Axel. I see you there on the Echo Link as well.
This is my question. You know how all the Christmas lights have changed into LED lights these days? When I look at them, my eyes like flash by them, they're all flickering, ding, 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 you know, around the room because of the 60 cycles. And I really don't like that, so I'm thinking that we ought to be able to put a diode in or a full wave bridge rectifier or something, make a special outlet that would just be a converter, AC to DC converter, just for Christmas lights as simply as possible. So my question is, what do you think the simplest possible way to do this? One diode, and would it stop the flashing, or are we going to put caps in there? So I'm not sure.
Okay, well, first things first, it probably pays better to just deck the tree in LEDs that are designed and built for a DC power supply, and then you get a power supply to convert the AC into DC. If you're going to stick with a rectified alternating current, you're going to have to put a smoothing capacitor in. Otherwise, you'll just get the same blinking at 120 times a second. So, you could get a filter capacitor. You have to make sure that the circuits are designed to deal with DC. There might be some circuitry that needs AC to do something special. So I would probably hunt down regular DC-powered LED. You know, they make them in all kinds of light strips and all manner of things. So it shouldn't be that much of a problem. But if you're going to rely on the rectified AC, assuming that there's no control box that's going to get deeply confused, you're going to need a filter capacitor to get rid of the flicker.
Shopping for more equipment, so I'm thinking about like what kind of ratings I need for the diode, the capacitor, and stuff like that to actually get a, you know, more smoother waveform, you know, that would just make them glow. Because I know it's just a string of LEDs, so why can't we switch it to DC and not have them flash? So I was going to make a plug attachment with a male plug and a receptacle and some components and see. But it'll burn down the house. I thought I'd ask you first.
I think you're going to burn out the house. You might kind of burn out whatever is inside the LEDs. Again, it depends upon the nature of these bulbs. Standard, you know, screw into the wall LED light bulbs would not take to DC very well. They have a lot of electronic circuitry that expects to see a 60 cycle AC signal. So the first things first, you got to figure out whether there's some kind of interface for the plug. Theoretically, it's a string of LEDs instead of incandescents, and there's a little box that does something, some magic to them, because I doubt that it's just feeding in AC 120 volts directly to a string of LEDs. So you have to kind of unfortunately reverse engineer what's going on in that little box. It might be possible to simply put a filter capacitor inside the box to smooth out the fluctuations, but without knowing exactly what the box that's feeding the power to the LEDs, and are they just naked LEDs, or do those LEDs have on-chip devices that are able to deal with AC. So it's a big question. I don't think, again, you're going to burn down the house. You might blow a fuse. You might ruin the string of LEDs, but I don't think it would be that calamitous.
On these LEDs, I know there. I have other ones that have flashing light stuff, and it's programmed, and you got to push the button to go ding, ding, ding. Those seem to be actually rectifying things to DC and doing it with DC. But I have these really cheap ones that are just like glass bulbs, and it's like a phosphor-coated strip inside each bulb. And even if you break the bulbs, they still work. You know, it's just the glass is broken, and it's a hazard. So it just seems like with these bulbs, it should be a way just to convert them so that they work on DC. Now, I don't know if it hurt them or not, but it seems that all I would really need is maybe one diode in a capacitor, but might have to do a full-wave bridge thing, or maybe they only conduct it one way anyway. So I want to know your opinion on that. Do you think they conduct both ways, or they're only conducting one way when you plug them in?
A rectifier bridge. It's the most efficient means for to get the power out, and it requires a less severe filtering capacitor, because then you got, you know, just 60 cycles a second, and half of the time it's not being energized. So it's kind of inefficient means of doing things. I don't know. You could do it either way, and then no one will arrest you. So yeah, the basic problem is you got to somewhat reverse engineer what the LEDs are looking for. It may very possibly be that it's a string of LEDs that are wired in parallel, which is why when one breaks, the others continue. And the way that it's dropping the voltage is with a simple capacitor. It's a very common circuit to have an LED hooked up to a voltage dropping capacitor. So if you do that and you feed it with DC, obviously nothing's going to pass the capacitor and it's not going to work. So, you know, it depends upon where the voltage dropping capacitor is placed. Is it in line, or is it in each of the little parallel LEDs as part of the on-chip type of configuration?
Counting on a voltage dropping capacitor, I was hoping there was a resistor in series with the LED that was dropping the voltage.
Okay, I mean, most of the designs that I've seen tend to have capacitors doing that.
I guess if there was a capacitor, then if you give it DC, it probably wouldn't work at all. So that kind of says that you're right as usual. And I shouldn't waste my time playing around, but it annoys me a lot. I don't know. Maybe a full-wave bridge rectifier would give it more pulse. I don't know. It seems interesting. Have you got a schematic about how that capacitor voltage dropping capacitor works? There's no resistor around the outside of it.
convenient for most of these designers to throw in a capacitor. You know, it gives you, it screws up the power factor, but no one cares of your your power usage. But it's a cheaper way of dealing with it, and you're not going to overheat the capacitor. As opposed to, you never know, you might overheat the resistor. It's just a capacitor in series with the LED. It's a very common way to do a significant voltage drop on the cheap.
Like there's a way to do that.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the big question that you brought up as well is if it's a full wave rectifier or a half wave rectifier. If it's a half wave rectifier, as you suggest, then switching it to a full wave rectifier would probably be a little bit better. I don't know if it would solve it entirely, but as I said before, it would go from a 60 cycle flicker, which is very easy to tell, to a 120 cycle flicker, which, you know, people with fluorescent light bulbs often don't even notice that their bulbs flicker. Or if they do, they notice it out of the corner of their eye, because peripheral vision is much more sensitive to persistence effects. So it can detect a rapid flicker where your central retinal image devices are blind to it. So if it is a half wave and you do change it to a full wave, which is just a matter of changing the rectifier bridge, that might help.
It also seems like if you do that, there's one way it won't work at all, and then you'd have to reverse the polarity, and then it would work the other way potentially, because you'd have to do the right polarity to make it go the right way.
Yes, but you could probably gauge the half-wave rectifier's position to orient the full-wave rectifier.
You give me a lot of thought. So what do you think the rating on the diodes should be? If I'm going to do this, you think, 1N0002 kind of like quarter watt would do it?
Well, again, it sort of depends upon the specs for the LEDs you're using. I assume they're rather low intensity. They're probably significantly less than a watt. So, yeah. And then a small power requirement is all that you probably would need. But again, just changing it, I don't really see where we're putting a diode, because the LED itself is a diode. So you're putting a diode on a diode. The only thing you're going to accomplish is a voltage drop. And so that even though it's rectifying it in the right direction, assuming it needs rectifying again, you're dropping the voltage, and that might be past its usability. So it might stop working even if you orient the diode in the proper orientation.
Yeah, that sounds right. You wouldn't get much success out of a single diode. It seems like you need a full-wave bridge rectifier if you're going to do anything. And even if you did, you may not have enough plus-minus excursion to get the capacitive resistive thing to actually provide enough, power through the capacitor to the light, because there's not so much difference across the capacitor in terms of the total voltage swing. So, yeah, a lot of problems with this idea.
It's an interesting premise. I don't know if it warrants all the time and trouble you're going to have to apply to it. It just seems like if you got about 2 or 3 weeks to kill, it sounds like a way to kill it. But I think you'd be better off if you had that problem if you bought a jigsaw puzzle instead.
I got some parts in the basement, and this thing is strung up on the wall, and like you say, the peripheral vision is much more sensitive. And, you know, because I've had a lot of eye operations, I'm really sensitive to all this flickering. So it's driving me crazy. You know, if they're incandescent bulbs like we used to have, they burn out too fast. So I'm just trying to think of a way to make life better.
Yeah, I completely understand. My nephew once upon a time had fluorescent lights in his bedroom fixture and was using a cold fluorescent light tube to light his LCD and his laptop. And the two of them were flickering at ever so slightly different frequencies. And using both of them together would make your eyeballs almost explode. So, you know, ridiculous. It was flicker of the LCDs plus out of sync flicker of the reflected fluorescent lights from the top of his room. So it was a painful experience. Thankfully, he changed his light bulbs to LEDs and eventually changed his the backlit of his laptops are now LEDs, and they don't have the flicker rate that fluorescent tubes had.
Yeah, well, theoretically, though, these light bulbs, these LED light bulbs, should be able to take possibly DC if I somehow cut out the capacitor, you know, shorted that out, and then it would work like an LED, right? But I'd have to give it a very low voltage, not a high voltage, right?
Yes. These native LEDs, they're light-emitting diodes. They are, for all intents and purposes, very, very similar to the diode that you use as a regular diode. If you do not cover a diode, diodes can emit infrared energy. It took time to design band gaps that produced emissions that were in the visible light spectrum. It can also detect light and produce a voltage potential in the light-emitting diode or the diode. So they work like diodes. And just think of it, you know, you really want to short out a diode with 120 volts. The idea is to get it somewhere near the voltage drop potential of the diode. You know, so if you're off by 100 times, you could imagine what that voltage potential is going to do to the fine structure inside an LED. If it's just a pure LED and there's no other nice little circuits that are protecting it.
String, do you think that, you know, 100 LEDs in a string, or maybe it'd be 250 LEDs in a string to get a 120 volt drop?
In parallel. And unfortunately, designers are kind of weird that way. Sometimes they will have a complicated bunch of wires. They'll have, you know, three or four serials with parallel interconnections so that all the voltages add up to the 120 volts that they're supplying on the AC line. So, you know, depending upon how complicated it could be partially parallel and partially serial connections.
Well, it's really hard to know. I guess I could look at it closer. But the thing is, well, I'd love to be able to change. I'd probably buy different bulbs is what you were really originally talking about. It was probably the only thing to do. But anyway, I think I'll experiment a little bit in the basement. So if I get a diode that's like rated for a couple hundred volts and a couple of amps, that must be a pretty big diode.
Yeah, that would probably be a big a diode. At the very least, you should consider, you know, somehow tapping in to the control boxes. I guess it's the control boxes wire output. Get an idea of how many conductors there are and what they're sending out. Are they sending out AC? Are they sending out DC? If you got an oscilloscope nearby, probably would be a nice idea to hook that up. see if it's a steady state DC or it's a fluctuating DC, just to get a better idea of what you're dealing with. You know, then you could maybe inspect the individual LEDs to see if they look like they're simple diodes that are only getting about, you know, 3 volts of voltage differential at their leads, or if it's a little bit more complicated. So I would trace a whole bunch of those wires and probe them and get an idea of AC-DC, how many volts, how many amps. And for good measure, a quick look at an oscilloscope to see what the power is looking like, whether it's steady or all over the place.
Okay, well, that was my Christmas treat for your last tech sitting before the holiday season. And anyway, thanks a lot for helping me figure this out. Maybe there's somebody out there that has a real technical question that would like to find out something on the Kings County Radio Club 2-meter net. So let's see if there's anybody else out there, Roy.
Or a topic for discussion, then please hit that push to talk.
Yeah.
Yes, sure, Axel. I'd love to hear one.
I'm saying a lot of questions. Different designs, different toroids and components. We know an MZ antenna is a compromised antenna, but this is what I found. Once people start to want to use more power than 100 watts, then a whole bunch of questions come. Some say add more toroids to the transformer. And then I saw that somebody made, without using toroids, they used a high capacitor, a high voltage capacitor with instead of using a toroid to make a transformer, they just made an air coil. So that air coil worked as the transformer together with the capacitor. Now my question comes like this. It's about more an intrinsic question. Why do they use toroid if they could use, in the beginning, an air coil? I asked somebody, and he told me that in their country they were lacking of good quality toroids. So for they just used coils, regular air coils, instead of using the toroids. One second, let me refresh. And as a proof, he told me that in certain transformers or tuners, they also used in the inside for to make the to make the matching. They also use air coils to do the matching. So I'm trying to get like more into the theory of the concept. Of why do they do those kind of different components in toroids? Why sometimes yes, why sometimes not? Is he right on his theory? Is he wrong in the theory? That's my question, Roy. KD2OVM.
That's a good question. I hope I have a good answer. Well, basically, inductors are coils of wire. Whether they have something in their core or not is independent of whether or not they're inductors. They're all inductors. The beauty of putting a ferrite or a toroid or some ferrimagnetic material is it collects the lines of magnetic flux, and inductors work by storing and manipulating energy in magnetic fields. So you allow them to store a far greater amount of energy in a far stronger, greater magnetic field using a ferrite. So if you don't need a lot of inductance, then you just make a couple of coils of wire and you're there. If you need a lot of inductance, you could either use a lot of coils of wire, or you can put some kind of a core in there that will increase the inductance. It's somewhat similar to the situation that we have with capacitors. You could make a relative high capacitance capacitor by making it very, very, very big, having both of the plates have massive surface area. It's mechanically troublesome and expensive, but you could do it. But then you could also have some dielectric material separating the two plates that have a high dielectric constant that are able to store energy in the electric charge that capacitors store energy in. So a ferrite simply is a means to have a smaller, cheaper, more powerful inductor. So I hope that answers the question.
Used on high power requirements, like let's say on they avoided using toroids on that. That wasn't because of the lack of ferrite toroids. It was because they were using high power. Let's say when they used on an amplifier or situation like that. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. Well, it's again sort of a similar situation. These materials are very effective in concentrating magnetic flux lines and making inductors with far higher inductive reactance. But they do have their downside, which is they're sensitive to heat. If you put too much power through an inductor, the magnetic field is going to increase the heat of the ferrite, and beyond a certain temperature, the material loses its characteristics and fails. So in cases of very high power, unless you can get materials that are very, very high temperature designed, you may have to deal with a large number of coils and air running through it that's not going to destroy itself by overheating. It'll just kind of heat up and rise to the top, and cooler air will take its place. So I guess if your requirements were so significant that the heat dissipation of the core would damage the core, then you have to deal with a air core as a solution.
Thank you so much for your answer, Roy. It clarifies a lot on the view of this, and I really appreciate for your input on this. Thank you so much. 82 OVL.
Okay, you're welcome, Axel. As always, you know where to find us if you need us. Let's see, it's only 9:40, although we did start a wee bit late, but if anyone out there has any other questions or comments to make, please feel free. Otherwise, I guess we'll go rather quickly to the TechNet puzzle. Which is a kind of easy one. It doesn't have any pictures, and I think most people will get it right. I hope they will. Anyway, if you got any other questions tonight, I'm available. Just hit that push to talk and give me your question or your comment or your topic. Okay, I guess we'll just go to the TechNet puzzle. William, did you read the TechNet puzzle for this week? Uh, Anyone out there interested in the TechNet puzzle? You know, I mean, if not, that's okay. But if anyone had an opportunity, I will read it. It says there are two types of coax listed below. Which of them are balanced and which of them are unbalanced? And they give you the two coaxes. It's a 50-ohm coaxial cable and a 75-ohm coaxial cable. So what they would like to do is ask you whether they're balanced or unbalanced. And they give you four choices of the four different ways that you could answer this. Is the 50-ohm coaxial cable balanced or unbalanced? Is the 75-ohm coaxial cable balanced or unbalanced? The way they say it is, A is 50 ohms is balanced and 75 is unbalanced. B is 50 ohms is balanced and 75 is unbalanced. C is the 50 ohms is balanced and the 75 ohms is balanced. And D is the 50 ohms is unbalanced and the 75 ohm coaxial cable is unbalanced. So A, B, C, or D, in which apparently A and B are identical. So you could factor that into it. So anyone with wants to suggest an answer for tonight?
To put any picture on there, but coax, regular coax, is unbalanced, according to what I learned.
I don't know if you heard me. The choice for unbalanced, both of them, is D as in Delta.
QWOT.
Yes, Chris. Do you hear me, Chris? A little confused by the lack of response of people. I don't know if something's weird going on with my transmissions or other people's reception or the repeater or what have you. But getting back to you, Axel, I think you meant to say D as in Delta. The fourth answer is that the 50-ohm coaxial cable and the 75-ohm coaxial cable are unbalanced. Is that what you were trying to answer?
That's right, Roy, that both coax lines are unbalanced. I think 2 years ago, more or less, there was a net. You presented a similar question, not the same. I think you brought a ladder line, and that's the one that is the example as a balanced one. And so, according to my knowledge, the rest, all regular coax are unbalanced. Now, if there's another example, if you have it, please let us know.
Coaxial cables are pretty much by definition unbalanced transmission lines. They are not symmetrical, whereas a ladder line, you know, you could slice a kind of line down the middle, and one side is the mirror image of the other side. A lot of people don't appreciate is that coaxial cables, you know, most people think of them as two wired devices, and current goes in two ways on those two wires, but they don't. A coaxial cable is capable of having current running in three different places. The outer aspect, because of the skin effect, the outer aspect of the center wire has one current. The inner aspect of the shielding has the other part of your signal that travels in differential mode up to your antenna feed point, into your antenna, and radiating to the world. But if something goes wrong and some of that energy gets reflected back, it can run on the outer aspect of the shield wire. That's the common mode that we talk about that's not isolated from the environment and capable of radiating like an antenna itself into all places, including people's shack. So you are perfectly correct. Both coaxial cables are unbalanced.
Like a third layer as a shield, what's that considered?
It sort of depends what you mean by that. What sometimes happens and is very common, LMR, which is a very popular low attenuation, low loss, high isolation coaxial cable, both has a tinned copper braid, and it also has an aluminum liner right on top of it. In that case, it's a little bit more complicated where the current kind of rides because it has more surface effect places, but it's still considered kind of a two-conductor with three currents type of a situation. People put multiple layers of shielding on their shield to improve the isolation and decrease the loss a little bit. In cable TV, there are 75-ohm quad shielded, the four layers of the braid, and then there's three other layers on top of that because they want the best quality and the least attenuation. But it's still considered three conductors, even though the actual current flow is a little complicated when it comes to skin effects.
Okay. Now, I thought that I saw once on a picture that they make coax with a double shield, but I have never the chance to handle my regular RG58 or LMR400, but I didn't realize that they use like a real third layer as a shield. But it's understandable that that is an unbalanced. Those are unbalanced lines. By the way, today I saw how they made I was curious and I saw a video how they make a J-Pol 10-meter antenna from a ladder line. And it was amazing to see how easy it is to make it. And it doesn't have just the purpose as a coax, just to receive the signal from an antenna. It could be used as an antenna itself, the coax or a ladder line. It was a wonderful thing to see.
The thumbnail for that, I didn't think a J-Pol design for 10 meters is so great. It's okay for 2 meters and such, because although it's not very efficient, it's basically a half wave end fed with an impedance matching stub. There's I think it's called a flower pot antenna. It's basically you strip away the outer shielding of the coax for about a quarter of the length, so the center wire becomes the one dipole, and the pulled down shielding that gets pulled over the coax cable becomes the other element, the other dipole in the center fed dipole. And so you have basically, you've turned a coax cable into just simple wire for a center-fed dipole. So it's not that difficult to do. A lot of times people will take twin line and cut it down the middle and extend either ends, and it works as a center-fed dipole. So as long as you get rid of the differential mode, in the differential mode where the two opposing currents are nearby, they neutralize each other so that they can't radiate. But once you separate those two layers, they're free to act like any other single wire and emit electromagnetic waves.
Right, right. You got it clear there. You put it very clear, Roy, how it works. One of the antennas that I have at home, it's a different type, but it's made with cotton, not with leather line. It's a double bazooka. And, okay, it's a different type of thing, because it shortens puts some short on the extremes of the dipole using the coax itself. The inside and the outside of the coax. But as you said, once you separate, it's not something that works together. Something that works separated, it works the RF through it to receive and to transmit as an antenna itself. Now, what you said, that on turn meters is not an efficient antenna, it's more like a compromise on turn meters. That is more, it's more useful for 2 meters. Probably because the loss is lower than on the 10 meters on a J-pole. I didn't catch that reason, Roy.
Yeah, it's not necessarily that it's less lossy at 2 meters, but it's a lot more convenient to work with, because rather than have some straggly thing, you can build it out of plumbing supplies, and it's relatively small, sturdy, and an easy thing to maintain. As opposed to if you're going to scale it up 5 times for a 10-meter device, I would imagine it's a little bit more fragile. So, having fragility and a degree of inefficiency, you're probably better off with something far simpler, like a real center-fed dipole or something for 10 meters, in my humble opinion. I mean, the guy's probably just trying to get some clicks, so he's presenting it. But I think if you ask most people on 10 meters what kind of antenna they use, I'm right now using a vertical 5/8 wave. Other people use center-fed dipoles. I don't know anyone that really uses a J-pole. It's kind of it's a curiosity as far as I'm concerned.
Right, it's more for experimenting, right? Most people just, when they make those antennas for 10 meters, they try to make it just to be steady there. They shouldn't touch them never again. They should stay there for years, right? And a J-pole might need some kind of assistance every so often, right? Okay, Roy, I might have to go now. I have a few things to do, but I'm really pleased to hear you on this net, that you keep doing it. Very happy with that. It was a pleasure to hear you. KV2OBM. Send to you.
73, Axel. Anyone else? So once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. This is going to be our one net for December. We'll be back January 10th because of the holidays and other such things. So if anyone has any closing questions or comments, now is a good time to make them. A 50-ohm coaxial cable and a 75-ohm coaxial cable. And the question was basically, was the 50-ohm coaxial cable balanced or unbalanced? And was the 75-ohm coaxial cable balanced or unbalanced?
I forgot to identify myself, but Oh, that's interesting. That I must have missed it. But I guess 50 ohm is balanced and 75 is unbalanced. Is that right?
No. Both coaxial cables, all coaxial cables are unbalanced cables. A balanced cable is pretty much a symmetrical cable. So if you draw an imaginary line through the middle of it, one is the mirror of the other. So if you think of open line or twin lead, they're parallel wires. They're mirrored, so they're balanced. Whereas the conductors on a coaxial cable is the outer aspect of the center wire and the inner aspect of the shield, which is not really symmetrical. So balanced by definition are unbalanced transmission lines, all coaxial cables. So the 50 ohm and the 75 ohm, and if you made one, and you can make one that's 150 ohms, it's just a matter of designing the dimensions a little different. They're all unbalanced.
Using it a little bit with 50 ohms versus 75 ohms and the conversions to matching, the impedance matching. But now that you said that, I remember some of that stuff from our previous conversations. Where a dipole is balanced while an end-fed is not. I think I'm hopefully getting that right.
Yes, indeed. That's a perfect example. Again, you take the center-fed dipole, draw an imaginary line through the middle of it, and one leg is pretty much the mirror of the other, which is the basis of how quarter waves work. In quarter wave antennas, you're actually sort of eliminating the mirror image, but then you're providing a replacement in the radials or the counterpoise, which sort of acts to replace the mirror element that you've removed.
Counterpoise on it kind of becomes a little bit more like a dipole. If let's say I take an end-fed, cut it for like let's say 10 meters, and then put a counterpoise of exactly the same length, does that make it a dipole?
Well, if you made it the same length, yes, and you'd have other problems. Everything, unfortunately, needs some degree of a counterpoise. True half-wave end-feds theoretically don't need one, but we don't live in a theoretical world. In a practical world, it tends to kind of use bits and pieces at the very edge as a kind of a tiny counterpoise. And if it needs more of a counterpoise, it will simply use your transmission line as a fix, which is why sometimes if you take an end-fed half wave and you RF choke it all the way at the beginning, your antenna is not going to work too well. It's always recommended to choke the transmission line after a length of transmission line, not right at the insertion point, because of that unfortunate reality that things that shouldn't need counterpoises need some counterpoises. Now, there's a lot of antennas that are unbalanced that have that are dipoles. Off-center dipoles as a group, Wyndham's being just one of them, has an off-center feed point. The feed point for a dipole is lowest at the center. As you move it towards the edge, it becomes higher and higher. Again, theoretically, the impedance at the edge of a half-wave end-fed should be infinite. But because we don't live in a theoretical world, it's only about 3,000 ohms. So, if you put it someplace farther than the middle, it'll go up to something like 300 ohms, and you get a ballon to reduce it to 50 ohms, and it works reasonably well. Some people really like off-center dipoles.
terms of that. Awesome. Thank you for explaining that.
That's what we're here for.
Questions. I'm going to do a little bit of research on the Zygo G90 and see if it's something I want to play around with since that research goes like next time we talk in January.
Good. I look forward to it. I hope everything works out with it. I was talking to someone about it who didn't know that, probably knew less than I did on it. He was concerned about the antenna tuner. I would assume it has a reasonably decent antenna tuner. I think someone told them it might be able to match 10-to-1 mismatches. That would be very unusual because Japanese radios, I realize this is a Chinese radio, but Japanese radios are pretty much known to pretty much match 3-to-1. 10-to-1's a rather aggressive capability that I wouldn't think that the Chinese would expend too much money into because it could make a unit more expensive. And they're trying to keep things inexpensive. So it'll be interesting to find out if you get it, how you like it, and how well you're able to tune on it and such. So I look forward to that.
Yeah, me too. I really doubt it can do a 10-to-1. I think at that point, once you get in those kind of impedance matches, there's potential for damage to the system. So kind of like you got to fix it in other ways before you bring it into the transceiver. I think there's a reason why it's 3. Like it's like up to 3, you kind of get a reasonable.
I've always tended to think it's sort of a Japanese thing, because if you go back to earlier American tubes and such, they were completely different. They actually usually had the antenna tuner secretly inside the radio. If you've ever seen people talk about tuning up the finals of their transmitters, it was this PI network, because tubes have a very high impedance. So you can't design a tube circuit that's going to work around 50 ohms. You're going to need an impedance transformer. So as long as you're transforming the impedance of the tubes, you might transform the impedance of the antenna as well. So the old PI network tuners on transmitters had that capability, and they, some of them could tune 10-to-1. And a lot of the extra antenna tuners available, both manual and automatic. Some of them can do 10-to-1. My Palstar, I joke that I could tune a doorknob. Some are better than others. I think just the Japanese being somewhat culturally fastidious thought that it was bad. It was not a good ham that had an antenna that wasn't resonant at least 3-to-1. So I think they were just annoyed. And so they kind of built that limitation into their equipment because they thought that that was the proper way of dealing with antenna mismatches and that no one should install an antenna that has a mismatch of 10-to-1. I haven't had that proved to me, but that's what I've been able to pick up between the lines.
One, let's say 5-to-1 or even 10-to-1. It requires more hefty hardware, right? In terms of that heat dissipation, transformers, like what would it require?
Two things, the mismatch and the general current carrying capacity. There are antenna tuners out there that are designed for 100 watts. There are tuners designed for 1500 watts, and there are a couple that are designed for 5000 watts. I know someone who owned one of those monsters, and certainly they need to be somewhat beefier, but I have seen relatively compact auto tuners that were capable of something close to 10 to 1. They were rated at about 200 watts, though. They weren't a full legal power, but it's doable. But it costs more. So that because of the Japanese tendencies to do that with transistor models, transistor-based transmitter final power circuits, which came on board in the late 60s, early 70s or something, it became pro forma. So pretty much now everyone who builds transceivers that put in antenna tuners will put them in for something like 3 to 1 or approximately that. For linear amplifiers, a lot of times, obviously, they kind of build them a little bit beefier, and you might be able to get 10 to 1 coverage. The problem, though, is it's not really 10 to 1 per se, because it's not only absolute impedance. You know, we talk about 50-ohm impedance and 100-ohm impedance. Impedance is a vector sum. So it has a absolute scalar quantity, which is what we always talk about, and then it has an angle, a vector angle. And so some antenna tuners can correct for a 600-ohm impedance for one phase angle, but not another. The trick is you can use a length of transmission line to rotate that angle into where your antenna tuner might be able to tune it. So a couple of other little bits and pieces about antenna tuners.
That's interesting. All right, well, check it out. I probably wouldn't trust that. I'm gonna look at specs, so I really doubt it does a 10 to 1 matching. Probably going to have to do a little bit of work on that. I think the two antennas I've been trying to work with, like one apparently is dead. The other one was giving me an SWR of 5 to 1, so a little bit of work there. But let's see, I got to see first if this is the kind of radio I want to play with, and then everything else will come after that.
Okay, good luck, Maxim. I'm sure you'll make the right decision. This hobby is a process of learning more and more about all kinds of things in our hobby. It's very diverse and divergent and deep. You could learn all there is about one thing or a couple of things about a lot of things. So it's a good field for a generalist.
Oh, I'm definitely a generalist. This is KD2VA. But yeah, I like learning about a lot of different things. So some things I get in deeper, but I do like learning about a lot of things. So it's been a good place to play. Yeah, well, thanks, Roy. Happy holidays. And I will talk to you in 2024. Wow.
Yes, happy holidays to you and to your lovely family, and your time flies when you're having fun. What can I tell you? 2024, geez. Anyway, thank you, Maxim. I'll throw it out one last time. I guess I kind of answered all the questions that are going to be asked tonight, but we'll try one more time. Anyone out there has any questions or comments to make before we call it a night? Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be January 3rd, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for a required link. Although our meeting informally begins after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. And, of course, this technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each and every month at 9 p.m. except for this month, in which we're just doing it once. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the Internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen more and talk less. It's time for us to roll this all up. We'll be back again January 3rd. Have a great holiday. Have a happy, healthy new year. Be well. Stay safe. And please come back next January 10th when we'll do this all over again. So thanks to everyone who participated. And, of course, my co-host, William AC2ZV. This is Roy AC2GS going clear and getting the heck out of here. Everyone be well.